Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Electronic Paper. As I said, weekly is probably not going to be, and it's been about a month since this week started. And so for the fourth episode, I want to get back on track to look at another paper from Complexity, Entropy, and the Physics of Information. This will be the second of those papers, and it has to do with the difference, in a way, between physical and information entropy, the entropy of a physical system, which has to do with statistical mechanics and thermodynamics and stuff like that, and the entropy that you get when you look at information theory. So I've always had my problems with that one, so I'm glad we found it here. Show notes for this episode can be found at papers.physicsfm.com/4. And it has reference data for this paper. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a copy of this paper online. So basically, that's all it has. When I get to the office, I have some simple books on entropy. I shouldn't say simple, but books on entropy that are at about, let's say, a sophomore level in college. I'll put up links to those. I think they're very good. I just don't remember the guy's name off the top of my head, so I'll update that some other time. Right now I'm at home and I don't have that book with me. So with that, let's get on with the episode. Well, hello. So like I mentioned two episodes ago, I wanted to try to get through this book, Complexity, Entropy, and the Physics of Information, that came out in 1990 or so, I believe, and just go through each one of the papers that's in it. The first paper was by John Wheeler. It was actually a fairly famous paper, where apparently he coined the term it from bit. The second paper, is by Benjamin Schumacher. Benjamin Schumacher, at this point, was a recent graduate from UT and then working at Kenyon College. And his contribution to this volume was Information from Quantum Measurements, which came from his PhD work. And basically what he's going to do is he's going to talk about entropy in the two ways we talk about entropy. One is the Shannon entropy, one is the entropy of information, and the other is the physical entropy. So he's going to talk about the connection between those two things. He's going to talk about the connection between them from quantum mechanics. And he's going to talk about what that actually means about stuff. And along the way, he's going to talk about Everett, the same Everett who gave us the many worlds interpretation. Although he's going to not talk about many worlds, he's going to talk about a conjecture from that same paper. So this is sort of a pre-quantum computing paper. He's talking about quantum communication, although it seems to be working towards quantum computing. I'm not sure how much of that is what I was bringing to this or how much of that was made explicit in his paper. What he wants to do is he wants to talk about communication and how that differs between information theory and physics. What do we mean? What is the difference between the sort of things that are similar in the two fields? When he's talking about communication, he's talking about the most general kind of communication you could have. That is, the delivery of information from A to B through some channel S with the given code C. And so this podcast is delivering information from me as A to you as B through a channel S called the internet with a code C, which is spoken English. So when we're talking about how much information is passed between you and me, we're talking about how meaningful the signal is, how meaningful that I'm sending you. That signal could be completely useless. That signal could be just a bunch of random sounds, which I'm not going to make because I have some dignity. But instead, I'm using a set of predetermined sounds, the code called English, that both you and I are familiar with. And so, at least to some level, what I am trying to say is very close to what you hear. They're not exactly the same things. We all know that. Something that I say is not necessarily something that you hear. It's amazing sometimes how different they can be. Probably not a big problem here, but you can see a lot of times when the communication is really important, not a podcast, but rather talking to your contractor about what you want them to do or something like that. Somehow, things don't always come across the way they're supposed to. You and he, you and me, we don't always have the same idea about what's supposed to happen.
I once lost an entire chimney because of this kind of problem. Maybe it's worse between you and me,
because there's no bottom line here, right? So maybe what I'm trying to say and what you hear are much, much different. But because there's no stake here, it doesn't really matter. We never find out that whatever I'm saying and whatever you're hearing are completely different things.
But when I come home and I have no chimney, it's pretty clear there was a miscommunication somewhere.
information didn't really transfer very well. So we're going to say better communication leads to fewer errors.
Fewer chimneys get torn down.
And we want to quantify that in some way.
And basically, that quantification ends up being the more ways there are to misinterpret something I'm saying, the less information there is in what I'm saying.
Well, in the 1950s, Claude Shannon came up with an interesting idea, which is to describe every sort of communication as a series of bits, zeros and ones. And at this point, you could be thinking about computers, but you could also be thinking about telegraphy. But you could also be thinking about a telegraph. If we send all that information out, how likely would somebody on the other side get the same information from that code that you sent out? The more likely that is, the higher your information content is. Fewer number of ways to make an error that changes the meaning of that communication. So the Shannon entropy is the uncertainty in the function. So when we have more information, we have lower entropy, because there are fewer ways to make a mistake about what was meant. So the better the communication, the more information you can give someone, the less entropy there is in the situation. A perfect message that you could not misinterpret would have zero entropy. So zero entropy is what we'd like to have in a communication shell. You can also add on noise, right? So on top of me being a bad speaker, there could be some problem like I did a bad job of editing the podcast, and so words drop out or they're put in funny orders or something like that. So on top of the entropy just from the message, there's an entropy from the noise. I think generally we're talking about the noise when we're talking about the Shannon entropy, just because that's what we generally think of, is that, you know, if we have a telegraph code. So in telegraphy, right, you send a wire to someone, but then all you really care about is, do all the letters show up in the right order? And probably they do. Probably they do. They got that worked out fairly well. There is noise in the system. There is noise in your computer, right? So the little packets of information going back and forth between the server and your computer to listen to this podcast have a little bit of redundancy built into them. You probably know this. And so that redundancy is used to check whether or not there's been an error in transmission. So a lot of times when you have a weak signal, the problem with having the weak signal isn't that data isn't coming in at the same rate. What's happening is more of that data is being corrupted.
And the computer uses a heuristic to check that all the data is consistent as it's coming in. Oftentimes this will include a test figure. And if that data isn't good, if that data does not match what the test figure would say it should, the computer will then ask for that data to be resent. And that's what slows down your connection when you have a bad signal.
One of the ways to check each packet of information that's coming to your computer from another computer is to look at, say, the sum of the ones in that
byte of information.
So if it's 1001001, that would be 3. So that would be an odd
parity. That would be an odd parity byte.
Well, then you'd have your last bit for that packet be 0 to indicate it was even, or 1 to indicate it was odd. You'd have that last bit in that packet of information. And if that doesn't work out,
then the computer will ask
the other computer to send you another packet of information. And usually these communication channels are stable enough that you only have one error at a time. If you have more than one error in any particular packet, that's going to screw everything up. That doesn't happen very much. The communication system is really, really good. That doesn't happen very much. The technology, the communication system, it's really, really good. And you can adjust the packet sizes to be small enough so that it's very, very unlikely that there'll be two errors. So, I mean, you could make a packet size that was a megabyte, in which case you have a non-zero chance of having two errors in that megabyte worth of transfer. But if you have it like a byte or something like that, then you have pretty close to zero chance of that happening most of the time. And so the noise is what we're generally concerned with. With the entropy, we're not really concerned most of the time about your interpretation and my interpretation of the digits. But that's because we're tech geeks, right? If we were more reasonable people, we'd care more about the message than the coding for the message. So that's called the Shannon entropy. It's the entropy of information theory. The question is how does that relate to the entropy, the physical entropy, the real entropy, the entropy in the real world? Well, I guess the first thing you have to think about there is, well, what is the entropy in the real world? Well, the entropy in the real world is a statistical concept. And this is how it's defined in your statistical mechanics classes. And I've actually seen this in first year textbooks now, too. So you'd have, say, a bunch of atoms in a box. Let's call that a magnet. Each one of those atoms in the magnet, each one of those molecules, it really depends on the magnet, but each one of the magnetic atoms in the magnet has an unpaired electron sitting in the top shell of the atom. And that unpaired electron can either point towards the north pole of the magnet or towards the south pole of the magnet. It has to do one or the other. And if the temperature were zero and you had a nice, long, thin magnetic needle or something like that, probably all of those magnets, all of those little atoms, those elementary magnets, they would point their spins, the spins of the unpaired electrons and all of those atoms of the magnet would point towards the North Pole. But it turns out that's not the case. It's not the case that we're at zero Kelvin. Instead, we're at a finite temperature, and what happens at a finite temperature is some proportion of those magnets are pointing the wrong way, of those elementary magnets, of those atoms, of those electrons have a spin pointing in the opposite direction, towards the South Pole, which means that the magnetization of the magnet is a little bit smaller than its theoretical value might be. Actually, it depends on the temperature and it depends on the magnet, but most magnets that you'd be familiar with are going to have a high Curie temperature, high temperature where the magnetism goes away. If you heat up a magnet, the magnetism dissipates. So you don't really see much of that. So what happens instead? That magnet is then going to have an entropy. If all of the little atoms are pointing towards the North Pole, there's no entropy there for the magnetic system. If some of them switch, then you have a problem. That's because when you measure the magnetization, you measure the magnetic moment of that magnet, there are different configurations that give you the same magnetic moment. So it doesn't matter if the fifth one is switched or the 23rd is switched or the 2,564th is switched or the 1.737 times 10 to the 21st is switched. Each one of those switches is exactly the same as far as your measurement of the total magnetization, because each one of those switches reduces the magnetization by the same amount. So for any particular magnetization, there's a huge number of different configurations that give you the same magnetization for that magnet, except when the temperature is zero and everybody's pointing in the same direction. At that point, the entropy is zero. For each other configuration, you have a higher entropy in that magnetic system. And there are some complications there. There are a lot of complications there. So you can see the similarities there between the two kinds of entropy. So for the first kind of entropy, for the Shannon entropy, for the information entropy, you have the number of ways this message can be interpreted. For the real entropy, you have the number of ways this physical system, this macroscopic system, can be realized microscopically. They're quite similar. They, in fact, have the same mathematical expression. That's how close they are. But they're not the same thing. First of all, if we want to look at this in, say, a quantum system with a spin or not, we'll use a spin, not a polarization. We're dealing with a mixed state. We have a slightly different situation here. We're dealing with this particle that could have a mixed state. So in a magnet, a regular magnet, let's say, we'd have the spins of those electrons would be highly correlated based on, you know, the exchange integral and stuff like that. In a ferromagnet, the spins of all those unpaired electrons would be correlated, highly correlated, because of exchange. Basically, the exchange acts like a torsion spring, trying to align all of the little magnets towards the North Pole, really with each other, but having them all pointing towards the North Pole or the South Pole. But if they all point to the South Pole is now the North Pole.
Since they all want to point in the same direction, the direction that they point in becomes the North Pole. However you got it there, no matter what it was beforehand.
But now if you were to take a stream of electrons and use those for communication, those electrons no longer have a preferred orientation. They're quantum mechanical, but they still have no preferred orientation. Yes, you take like a Sturm-Gerlach device and you measure them in the x direction, they're all going to have an orientation in the x or the minus x direction. If you take the z, they'll have an orientation in the z or the minus z direction, but they aren't really pointing in the x direction or the z direction. In fact, they're unable to point directly in the x direction or the minus x direction or the z direction or whatever. You force that z component, you force that x component to be in the x or the z direction, let's say, or the minus x or the minus z direction. But whichever direction you make it point in, it still has components in the other two directions. And as long as they're in a field, that's going to persist. The other two directions are going to change, randomly spin around that Z direction. So that all of these electrons that you're sending in this communication channel could have an unlimited amount of information in them, which is exactly not what happens in your telegraph or in the bits in your computer, which are just giving you zeros and ones, zeros and ones, zeros and ones. So that's a little bit different right there. So what that means is the information entropy of that chain is less than the entropy of that chain. And this is helped by the process of quantum measurements. So like I said, you have these bits, these qubits, I guess we call them today, with an infinite amount of information in them. You can set them precisely if you want, right? But when you measure them, you can only measure something log 2. You can measure Z up, Z down, right? You can measure X up, X down. You can measure any one of those angles in between the Z and the X direction, but only up or down. Once you do that, the rest of that information is destroyed. The rest of that information has nothing to do with your original signal. So even though you have this infinite amount of information in your quantum signal, you still only get the logarithm of the number of atoms in your signal as the amount of information you can extract from it. So we have two different things. The amount of information in it, which is related to your quantum system, which is related to your physical system, and the amount of information you can extract. Two different things. And those things are related. That shouldn't be surprising. What it means is that the entropy of your ensemble, the entropy of your actual physical bits, there's more uncertainty in it, there are more ways to arrange it, than there is the information that you get out. There's more entropy in the real world than there is in a signal. That shouldn't be surprising. There are more ways to interpret the real world than there are to interpret as strings of ones and zeros, even based on some sort of quantum measurement.
So the entropy that you'd extract from a quantum communications channel
is less than or equal to the entropy of the channel, the entropy of what you have, less the mean entropy of all your messages, all the possible messages that you send. And that is called Kolobov's theorem. After a guy named Kolobov, who had published this in 1973, I think, in the USSR, entitled, with the usual florid prose of a Russian physicist, Bounds for the Quantity of Information Transmitted by a Quantum Communications Channel. And Schumacher goes on to explain how this works with quantum multiplexing and things like that, very briefly, so briefly that I'd need to look something else up to explain it. So furthermore, Schumacher decides that he can prove Everett's conjecture this way. Now, Everett's conjecture had nothing to do with multiple worlds. It was just that the correlation between observables should be limited by the subsystem entropy. That is, if you have an entangled quantum state, how much correlation you can get is related to the entropy of the subsystems where you're doing the measurements.
If you have a measurement in Selenium, if you have a measurement in Jesse, something like that,
then the correlation is limited by the entropy in those two subsystems. And the subsystems include not only the thing you want to measure, but what you're measuring with. That means that your measurement apparatus is part of that. So if you have these two detectors,
like we looked at in Physics Frontiers number 44, spooky action at a distance,
then each of those detectors contributes to the entropy and therefore limits the correlations that can actually occur. And this is one of the things that keeps you from sending a signal faster than light. If that was not true, at least, then you could send a signal faster than light. Probably the latter is more fundamental than the former. But basically, this particular property breaks up the measurements so that even though you can later check these two measurements and find the correlations and show there's this spooky action at a distance, each of those results is independent of the other. In 2 weeks, when I do the next article in this thing, we'll talk about something similar again. That's what Schumacher did. He used Kolobov's theorem to prove Everett's conjecture, which sounds like a good time. So the final conclusion here is that the most efficient coding would have eigenstates, energy eigenstates with a thermal distribution, and no coding scheme can send more information than allowed by the thermal distribution for your particular system. Which is about it. I believe the next one, local accessibility of quantum states, says something similar. Thank you very much for listening. I hope this was helpful to you. Hopefully it was helpful to me. It sure was helpful to me. So I will talk to you again next time. Bye now. So this has been the Weekly Electronic Podcast, episode number 4, Entropy versus Entropy. Show notes for this episode can be found at papers.physicsfm.com/4. That has some data for this episode, but unfortunately there wasn't much of it. The paper wasn't online as far as I could find, at least find easily. I really don't think any of our Physics Frontiers podcasts were reasonably close to this topic. Like I said at the beginning, I'll put up a couple of links to books on entropy that I think are reasonable. There's a guy who does a pretty good job that I like that has a lot of books on entropy at maybe the freshman or sophomore level. Like I said, he does a good job. So if you'd like to learn a little bit more about entropy, about what entropy really means, those are probably some pretty good books to look at. And that's really the best I can do for this one. We'll see what I can do next time. Next time I will be looking at a real paper. That paper, I think, will be very, very complicated. It is short. It's like 3 pages. But I got it from another book that was a graduate lecture notebook, I think. And the footnote said, this sort of thing here, where I'm talking about why for electricity and magnetism, the force is repulsive for like charges, and for gravity, it's attractive. This particular paper is really, really difficult, and you probably shouldn't even look at it. Just take my word for it sort of thing, which for a graduate seminar is probably saying it's really, really difficult. There's something in there that needs a lot of background, and I've skimmed over it, and there are things I really just don't understand. So hopefully I'll get to that this weekend, but it might take a little while. There might be a lot of things that I keep going back and back and back for to try to actually understand what he's talking about. So that will be an interesting thing to talk about. I've wanted to look at that paper for a long time. But like I said, it's a little bit daunting. A little bit daunting when somebody says, look, graduate students who are actually interested in this stuff, I want to do it for the rest of your life. Maybe hold off until after the second postdoc. All right. So I will get that to you as soon as I can. And hopefully that will be something you're interested in. All right. Look for that, and I'll talk to you then. Bye now.